In Dr. Faustus, Marlowe presents us with a fantastic attempt to bring out the full self out of the magic. Dr. Faustus. And Marlowe's conclusion is that no such thing is possible for man, that only God's pity, giving that as a gift, makes it possible for man, that man in his own power and his own capacities just is not able to do this. Whereas in Shakespeare, the realization is that we, in fact, do have the capacity and power to do this, and that it is not rare at all, but it happens almost all the time where there is a situation that allows for the human being to mature. It's not a rare occurrence. It's rather the way in which human beings mature. It's rare to have someone who can express it, but it's not rare at all as an occurrence. This is Shakespeare's understanding. That Shakespeare's plays were not presented in monasteries to competent English Renaissance yogis, but were presented to the people, the street people of London, anybody who came in. And his confidence, my confidence too, is that it can be freely given, because only those who are capable will understand anyway. All the rest will find ways not to understand. And you don't have to worry about esoteric secrets being thrown away. For the uninitiated, any excuse to botch it up will be enough, even one. Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream, as I've given you a couple of excerpts, has a peculiar character, a character who is outside as well as inside the play, and that is Puck. Puck's alternate name is Robin Goodfellow. Goodfellow. Good person. There's a Robin in Faustus, in Dr. Faustus. Let me just give you a passage in Dr. Faustus where Robin is, and then we'll take a break. Robin and another servant named Ralph, the English pronounce it Rafe. Robin enters with a book in his hand. What book does he have? He has Dr. Faustus's conjuring book. Oh, this is admirable. Here I have stolen one of Dr. Faustus's conjuring books. And in faith, I mean to search some circles of my own use. Now will I make all the maidens in our parish dance at my pleasure stark naked before me, and so by that means I shall see more than e'er I felt or saw yet. Rafe comes in. Robin, pray thee, come away. There's a gentleman tarries to have his horse, and he would have his things rubbed and made clean. He keeps such a chafing with my mistress about it, and she has sent me to look thee out. Pray thee, come away. Keep out, keep out. Or else you are blown up. You are dismembered, Rafe. Keep out, for I am about a roaring piece of work. Come, what doest thou with that same book thou canst not read? Yes, my master and mistress shall find that I can read, he for his forehead and she for my private study. She's born to bear with me, or else my art fails. Why, Robin, what book is that? What book? Why, the most intolerable book for conjuring that ever was invented by any brimstone devil. Stop there. And if I seem sometimes a little abstracted, it's just the discipline of not feeding that beginning of self-pity in you. I have a lot of care for you. Don't worry about that. But I don't want you to mistranslate it in a sentimental way. You need to have a full person vigor about the situation and not a mask-like sentimentality about it. The material that we're dealing with here in magic, the traditional way of presenting it was too occult. And so in our time, the presentation is being changed. The Western tradition is being modified and changed. The person who began the change was Mr. Hall. And I'm carrying on as best I can. The change is, instead of presenting magic in the occult way, is to present it in its symbolic, structural way. Now, for Jung, in Jung, the whole emphasis is on individuation, on the person coming out. But that's not the be-all and end-all, though it is in terms of the accepted limitation of psychology, the accepted purposeful limitations of psychiatry, the individuation process, the healthy individual who's able to live in their own life is the purpose. But in the wisdom tradition, that is recognized, always recognized, as the penultimate purpose. That is, it's one stage shy of the ultimate purpose. In the wisdom tradition, the purpose is not to individuate, but to individuate in such a way that you can release your spirit. The only reason to have a firm personal grasp is to consciously release your spirit. So that with somebody like Yeats, the whole emphasis, instead of being on the person, is on the spirit. And Yeats's concern is to make the person pervious to the energies of the spirit. And so Yeats's person is rather like a mystical sieve which allows the spirit to go through. Whereas Jung's emphasis was on the person, Yeats's was all on the spirit. Mr. Hall is the balance between the two. His outlook is the person must be shaped and the spirit must be freed by that person. What we call the spirit has a shape, but in psychic energy, it's in an energy mode and doesn't have a shape. That's why the person has to be like a prism to focus that shape. But if the person commandeers that energy for themselves, then the spirit still isn't free. That's the essence of lust or greed or anger, incidentally. It's mine. And whatever uses I put it to are my uses. Well, that's what's wrong, you see. So there's a latent egotism in Yeats, in Jung's viewpoint, if you like. Jung sidesteps it a lot because of his own excellence and his own genius. But many Jungians are as egotistical as you can get. And those who are learning from them are out-and-out brats. And there are problems with trying to see the human person as such as osmotic transparency or translucency, that one isn't really there. One is only, as it were, a living crystal. That's not right either. The balance is that the spiritual energies and the person and the deep self and the mask-like sketches, towards all that, all of this is an entire whole ecology of the real. And the entire ecology is what is real. And every stage and every aspect has its season, has its place, and all of it is essential. Can't throw any of it away. I heard once, I cannot remember who said it. It wasn't what I read. Somebody said it once in a seminar. It might have been Professor Mark Blum, who the last time I saw him was sitting barefoot with a galvanized wash tub full of carrots. He was sitting in his office, and he was teaching a seminar, a graduate seminar in Jungian psychology, and he said he needed the balance. I think it was Blum, Professor Blum, who said that we have to have the right to make mistakes and to appreciate that the mistakes are essential to our fullness. We have to be able to have the right to make mistakes. And those mistakes are a part of our fullness. So that nothing really can be thrown away with impunity. One of the egotistical flaws which creeps into ascetic disciplines is that somehow you've got to get rid of the flaws. And of course the classic case of showing that you cannot get rid of the flaws is the young Milarepa, how he was enlightened by his teacher Marpa. It is a world classic case that you cannot get rid of the flaws. That instead of weeding them out, you learn to express a new dimension which includes those flaws and transforms them. A classic little vignette of a wisdom story in medieval Christianity was this story of St. Christopher trying to help everybody across the stream. And one traveler, who's Jesus in disguise, gets on his back and he gets out in the middle of the stream and he gets heavier and heavier and heavier, and finally Christopher can't make it across. And the passenger tells it, "You can't carry the whole world on your back." It isn't the way that I did it. I don't carry the world on my back. I make it possible for the world to cross over, and I don't do the carrying. Whereas you're making the mistake of thinking that you have to do the carrying. And there's no way that you can carry the whole world across the stream. You can't even carry me. This is in the medieval St. Christopher legend. The person is necessary, but the person is not born out of nature, but out of the magical realm which transforms the social and cultural realm that one lives in into the deep self realm of the symbolic understanding of its meaning. The person is born again out of the meaning. Just like we talked about in Thursday night, the Upanishad series. In classical India, everyone who is anyone at all is twice born. If you aren't twice born, you're an outcast. Whereas in the evangelical United States, being born again is like some kind of really special revelation. It was just the social norm 4,000 years ago in India. And being twice born, one is born again out of the awakened deep self. One is born to have symbolic comprehension, so that you don't just perform rituals, you know what they're for. You perform them consciously. You perform them because you want to perform them. Not because it's proscribed by law, but it's what you intend to do as a person. I am going to do this. So that the offering is not an indistinct offering of mechanical power, but is a very distinct offering of personal conviction. And it changes everything. He who is at home in the mansion lives there. The God within then is at home. So this magical realm is a birthing medium, just like nature is a birthing medium. Nature is a transformational medium, and what gets born out of that is parallel by what gets born out of the deep self. But what gets born out of the deep self is born magically and not ritually. It's a different thing. In fact, it is like 180 degrees difference, because whereas the ritual is objective, being born out of a transformational process nature, the magical coming out of the deep self is a transformational process coming out of the objective. This is why sometimes you'll see a mystical diagram that the devil is the reflection of God, is inverse. The demonic, the magical realm, is the inverse of the divine realm. It's a clumsy way of a mythologically conditioned consciousness of misunderstanding what's going on. The diagram is all right, and it's accurate enough in its limitations, but it's a mind game and has nothing to do with reality whatsoever. So that what one is to understand is not that there is a mirroring, doubling going on, but that there is an expressive complementation going on. And whereas there is no mirror, there certainly is a unity. And that the complementation is real in terms of the unity, but no one side of the complementation is real in itself. There's no yin which is real without the tai chi. There's no yin anywhere that's objective. There's no yang anywhere that's objective. That is only real in terms of the unity. And so in the magical horizon, the reality is in the realization that the wholeness is in the self, and that the magical transformational media is real in its entirety, and that any aspect of it is just in process of coming to express its entirety. The only reality in the magic realm for you is your person, and that must be manifested out. Your person is as real as anything there is in this universe. Your person. Your person is not just an ambiguous, hopeful, characteristic sketch, but is an actuality. So much so that the language of religious experience is always that God wishes to save man. You can find this in all different religious presentations. In higher Buddhism, it is said that all sentient beings must be saved. Not even just all persons in human form, but all sentient beings in whatever form must be saved. And until they are all saved, the salvation is not real for anyone. What is the Western paradise? The blessed Western paradise, the realm of Amitabha. Those who have come to conscious enlightenment, but they are not saved yet. They're saved and held in the Western paradise. What are they doing in the Western paradise? And if you see illustrations of the Western paradise, everyone there is reading or singing, playing instruments. They're all working towards expressing and manifesting the truth for the entirety of all sentient beings. They're working to help others. Because it's only when all are saved that salvation is real for anyone. Hence the Bodhisattva ideal, that it would be an inflated illusion to think that one could be finally freed while there is still anybody else in chains. And so the ideal is that everyone else must be saved before I myself accept enlightenment. That in itself is not from a partially enlightened being, but is the doctrine, the code of an enlightened being. The only way to make my salvation real is for all other sentient beings to be saved also. And they must be saved before I can, in fact, be saved. That itself is enlightenment, the Bodhisattva ideal. So there are lots of different ways of presenting this. In the way that I'm taking for you, in order to help the person and the freedom of the spirit to be consonant with the focusing of the deep self and the symbolic mode, so that all three of those are lined up, as it were, operate as parts of one ecology. There is a balancing fourth part that must be brought in, and that is on the ritual level. It's what we do. And the ritual level, the level of the mask, the level of the personae, is also then a level which is retroactively transformed by symbolic comprehension. It ceases to be just the ritual ceremonial level and becomes, in retrospect, symbolically, the level of the stage, the level of drama. The ceremony of the tribe is transformed into the play of the playwright. So that there is a definite kind of a correlation. Now, in respect of Greek tragedy was a ritual development that came out of archaic, prehistoric, peasant village society that matured itself patiently through many phases of civilization, but was quite accurately still what we would call primitive or primordial. It was still ritual in a place like Athens up until the time of Solon, up until the time of about 600 BC. In Attica, in the district of Athens, one could still find the old goat song. Tragioi means goat song. One could still find the primitive ritual in the 7th century outside of Athens, and even in the city itself. In a couple of generations, though, just a couple of generations, a transformation was made, and that ritual structure was transformed into the structure of Greek tragedy. And it happened just like an alchemical transformation would happen. As soon as the transformational media became supersaturate, the old forms dissolved in the primordial energy, and that primordial energy supersaturating the transformation media, the new form came out whole. Like that. It precipitated just like a salt can crystallize out of water. The structure is whole. So that the first tragedy, the first real tragedy, was Aeschylus's The Persians. And in The Persians already, you have the complete structure of Greek tragedy. Later, there were realizations that you could emphasize aspects of it. You could bring in, for instance, a second speaker. You could bring in other aspects. They were fleshing out, but there was no real change in the symbolic structure. The rediscovery of that in the Renaissance, the rediscovery that symbolic structure on the level of the deep self comes out whole, was made in Florence. And the person who was responsible for that was Marsilio Ficino, who was the great translator. He translated all of Plato. He translated all the Hermetic treatises. He translated all of Plotinus. He translated almost all of the ancient tradition. The young Michelangelo, as a teenager, grew up around the old Ficino and absorbed around the dinner table a lot of what he would put into his work later on. Shakespeare is the last great resonance of the Renaissance. And he is the one who understood, finally, that by consciously using the dramatic structure of tragedy or of comedy, one could make an expressive mode which would allow one, through this ritual level, through this dramatic participation, to prepare the kind of focus of the deep self that would more naturally refocus as a person later on, as the kind of person who could naturally free the spirit. And so Shakespeare is like Homer, or like Aeschylus. He is like a universal, I guess we've run out of tape. The screws go out? Is that it?
Yes.
Shakespeare is like a universal voice. And it doesn't matter whether you have Shakespeare translated into Russian, like many people have struggled with Shakespeare in Russian, and the best translator was Boris Pasternak, who found a way to say in Russian what Shakespeare said in English, so that Pasternak's Russian Shakespeare is in fact a Russian Shakespeare. The difficulty of translating Shakespeare into German was the whole cause of the romantic movement around the Schlegel brothers and Scheller and so forth. Shakespeare can be translated into Japanese quite adequately, can be translated into Chinese. Because what Shakespeare writes about is a universal experience, the experience of how the play creates the right basis by which meaning can be generated and focus at a level deep enough to reach the inner self. And that focus is deep enough to reach the inner self when it can refocus its effect on the person in their own life. So that such a writer as Shakespeare helps us to become real unto ourselves, in such a way that we understand that part of our purpose of being is to be a frame of reference, a door through which our own spiritual energies can be freed, to bring them to focus in ourself in such a way that when the time comes, they can be let go. Now, Shakespeare is extremely difficult when you get to the later plays. Probably the most powerful of all of his plays is The Tempest. Or one can go to the tragedies like Macbeth or Lear or Hamlet and find an intensity which is almost incredible. But it's very difficult unless you have some kind of a background, some kind of an acquaintance with acting, some kind of an acquaintance with literature, some kind of an acquaintance with language, to appreciate Lear or Macbeth or The Tempest. But A Midsummer Night's Dream is exactly the right entrance point. It's sophisticated. It does what Shakespeare at his best does, but it does it in a way which is easiest to understand, easiest to bring into oneself, and that's why we're using it. Now, in Dr. Faustus, which is like the failed twin brother of A Midsummer Night's Dream. Dr. Faustus is the example of man failing to bring himself together, failing at mastering the language. Look how in Dr. Faustus, I've taken from it you know the story of Faustus who wants to make a pact with the devil so he can have all kinds of power. He says in here, "'Tis magic, magic that hath ravished me. Then, gentle friends, aid me in this attempt. And I that have concise syllogisms gravel the pastures of the German church and made the flowering pride of Wurttemberg swarm to my problems as the infernal spirits. O sweet Musaeus, when he came to hell, will be as cunning as Agrippa was, whose shadows made all Europe honor him." Agrippa, the author of a very powerful magical treatise on natural magic, used here by Marlowe as the example of a very powerful magic language. You have to understand from a mature standpoint that Agrippa was a flawed understanding. But he was flawed in such a way that he couldn't realize it. There's still extant a letter to Agrippa from his teacher in magic, Trithemius, who tells him in very subtle language that he has not really understood. He has understood preliminaries and sketches. And Agrippa printed it with his own manuscript, thinking that this was a good promotion for him. He didn't understand that his teacher was telling him to grow further. But Trithemius, incidentally, was very capable magician. For Marlowe, Faustus seeks to imitate Agrippa. He seeks to master the magical language, not to do things from the language, but to manifest the central figure behind the magic. He doesn't know that it's his own self. He thinks rather that it is Lucifer. Put it into Protestant terms. He thinks that by conjuring Satan, Satan who controls the world, can then give him whatever he wants in the world. He doesn't understand that his deep self is the fount of the magic and not Satan at all. Satan is a polarized mask, a polarized persona of the negative aspect of the self. And if you think that that can be separated out from the unity of the self, then you are living in delusion. And part of the delusion is that you will believe in your own projected satanic mask. And that's the hell of it, that you do believe it. So Dr. Faustus has all of these elements which are expressed within the play. This is the way in which he conjures up Satan. Now that the gloomy shadow of the earth, longing to view Orion's drizzly look, leaps from the Antarctic world into the sky and dims the welkin with her pitchy breath. Welkin is like world. In other words, he's choosing the coldest, most nether part. He's choosing the Antarctic of the earth when it's in the deepest shadow, pointing towards Orion. Orion would be a constellation that comes up at twilight. If it, the shadow of the earth points, it's at midnight. Midnight in the Antarctic is the place in which my words will leap off the earth with a pitchy breath to conjure forth Lucifer. Notice that Lucifer, the name for Satan, Lucifer actually means light bearer. The name actually is an epithet for the inner self, the radiant inner self. But to think of that as Lucifer, a demonic, a mask, is already to be thoroughly deluded. And to follow it up again, that's the hell of it, that one is accepts the delusion as if it were real. And then Faustus continues, according to Marlowe's play, the tragedy of Dr. Faustus is the play. Faustus, begin thy incantations, and try if devils will obey thy hest, seeing thou hast paid and sacrificed to them. Within this circle is Jehovah's name, forward and backward anagrammatized. Well, he thinks that if you put the name of God in an anagram, powerful symbolic form, then write it forwards and backwards, then one must have both sides covered. One must have the mirror image as well as the image itself. Can you understand that Marlowe is presenting Faustus very accurately? He doesn't understand. He thinks that the complete diagram is efficacious, as if it were real. The unity of a diagram doesn't change its diagrammaticalness at all. The map is not the territory, even if it's a good map. It doesn't matter how good the map is. The abbreviated names of holy saints, figures of every adjunct to the heavens, and characters of signs and erring stars by which the spirits are enforced to rise. That is to say, not only are the names anagrammatized, but that the sigil forms in their constellation correlates are also put into the diagram. Thinking then that if he includes all of this, that somehow it's going to increase the efficacy. It just increases the complexity of the diagram. It doesn't change the diagram into any kind of turf at all. By which the spirits are enforced to rise. Now, where are the spirits? The spirits are psychic energy. That's that realm of the spirits, the realm of the fairies, the realm of fairy powers, the fairy faith, the realm of magic. Can they be enforced to rise? It's misunderstanding completely. Those psychic figures rise spontaneously from the inner self. You would be hard-pressed in all of your ingenuity to stop them from rising. When the inner self radiates, it radiates like the sun shines. To think that you could enforce their coming forth is already to be deluded on at least two levels, and maybe three. But Marlowe is presenting this quite accurately. He presents Faustus very accurately. Marlowe's limitation is that he thinks that Faust is the ultimate of what man can really do. And so he presents Faustus as a tragedy, showing that the devils carry him off at the end. And the only thing that would save him would be God's pity. But God can't pity him because Faustus can't bring himself to believe that God could really pity him. And therefore he's carried off by the devils. He's carried off by his own inability to unbelieve his delusion. We can put it in that kind of psychiatric language. If you cannot disbelieve your delusion, then you're going to remain in that tortured condition. The karate of psychic health is to learn that you can disbelieve delusion. And it's like adding a double negative. It cancels out. You don't have to even learn fancy yogas. You can learn to turn it off. Did it? Thank you. Are you able to follow? Are you able to see? I'm talking around and around an insight. The insight is that psychic energy radiates like in an emanation from the symbolic self. That radiant field is the field of psychic energy. That's what psychic energy is that radiant field. That radiant field has an archetypal propensity to not only radiate out, but to radiate out in such a way as that it refocuses as a person. That's its nature. Not to just keep going out, but to go out in such a way that it comes in and focuses as a person. We'll wait for more machines. What is the real form of that radiation? What is the real form of psychic energy? The real form of psychic energy must be, and I've stressed this almost like a rule of physics, it must be consonant with the meaning that went into constituting the deep self in the first place. Psychic energy cannot be different from the meaning that went in to constitute the deep self. So that psychic energy and meaning are a single ribbon that twists once, and in the twist makes the deep self. What is that ribbon? Language. Language. Now, given this kind of an image, and incidentally, this is an image eternelle, if you can picture that in your mind, if you picture the ribbon of language twisted once, not twisted derisively in the sense that it's screwed up, but twisted in the sense that it's now transformed in such a way it's like a Mobius strip. Instead of one side reading out, now the other side reads out. The side that previously read out is now hidden, and the side that was reading out now was previously hidden. Both sides were always there. Always there. So that magic and myth, those two kinds of language, are two sides of the ribbon of language. And that the ribbon of language is obviously the form in which the transformational process of the deep self occurs. If you've understood that, if you are able to follow that, you can see then that the characteristic traditional way of talking about the deep self is that it is a region of meaningful silence. Or one of the hermetic ways, beautiful hermetic way, was that at that point one has to keep silent so that you can hear God talk.